Finding Alternatives to Pain Management as a Way to Battle the Opioid Crisis. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The opioid crisis is responsible for thousands of deaths in South Florida in the past couple of years, but it's hitting different socioeconomic groups in different ways. We're going to look at one angle to the problem, pain management and alternative treatments. Plus, Danielle Bender is bringing beehives to public spaces and helping people overcome their fears of bees. Also on the show, a look at Haitian Heritage Month and...
Are we friends who are too close? Or lovers who aren't close enough?
Former Marjorie Stoneman Douglas singer-songwriter Sonali is about to perform at Sunfest on the same stage as Pitbull. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news.
When I see your lips, I remember.
Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Hope you're having a wonderful day. Thank you so much for tuning in. Well, the opioid crisis has already had a devastating impact on South Florida communities. In Palm Beach County alone, there was more than 1,000 deaths from opioids over the past couple years, 600 in 2017 alone. Miami recently joined a number of cities across the country filing a civil lawsuit against pharmaceutical companies for fueling the opioid crisis through false or deceptive advertising. To understand the roots of the opioid crisis in South Florida and to learn about alternatives to sometimes addictive medications, we're going to be joined now by Dr. Dennis Patton. He's an anesthesiologist at the University of Miami whose work focuses extensively on pain management. Dr. Patton, it's such a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Luis, for having me on your show.
Well, let's start by this. Let's break down the various factors that have led to the opioid crisis. And is it as simple as just saying this is about pain management?
Well, you could say so. Pain is very misunderstood. It's the most common symptom that humans, patients, experience, but it's the newest field of medicine. It's only been around 50 to 100 years, so we're still in the infancy of our understanding of pain and how to treat it.
Is it, well, let me ask it this way. Why are primary care physicians more likely to prescribe opioids to address pain problems?
Okay, well, the main reason is they lack training in pain management. It's really not a part of traditional medical education. Maybe one lecture, if that, in traditional medical schools. So you have the bulk of the prescribers of opioids without training of what pain is, how to assess a patient, diagnose a condition, and treat it with the right tools.
Haven't lawmakers been working on basically trying to suppress how much opioid medication can be prescribed?
Yes, they have. There's a recent bill that Governor Scott just signed restricting acute prescriptions for opioids for acute pain to 3 days or 7 days. It's been postulated that prescription opioid exposure is one of the leading causes of addiction, that addicts people who have a problem get started with something, and it's often leftover medication in the medicine cabinet.
Well, doctor, I mean, you personally, what do you think about that? Do you think that's enough?
No, it's not enough, but it's at least a step in the right direction. Maybe a 3 or 7 day limit is too short a time period. I think the FMA and other doctor organizations would like to see that extended, but I'm glad it's happening because it'll lead to a reassessment of what pain is all about and how it can be treated. And I don't think the medical profession could have done it on their own. It needed to happen from a governmental perspective.
So I want to talk about pain as well. You're, as an anesthesiologist and someone working in pain management, you use a variety of treatments and alternatives to treatments. If I'm suffering, let's say, from severe back pain, for instance, I mean, besides opioid medications, what else would you tell someone like me? I'm sure you've seen those kind of people all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would all depend upon whether it's acute pain or chronic pain. If it's acute pain, you've had it for a few days or a week or so. Most of all those patients get better over time. It's a muscular injury. Unfortunately, the initial treatment might be an opioid, which is not necessarily the right treatment, has not been shown to change the course of the disease. If pain persists over a period of time, let's say 3 months, and it becomes a chronic pain, that's really changed the nervous system. It's a complex chronic condition that is a disease unto itself. And what works in acute situations doesn't necessarily work in chronic conditions.
And so at what point do you decide, okay, this needs medication, or no, there are other things that we could do to help the patient right now?
Well, we assess the patient first and then come up with a diagnosis. Too often a patient doesn't even have a diagnosis, or they have conflicting diagnoses. So we educate them and give them reassurance that, that we can take care of their pain and treat it and understand it. Then it's a continuum from reassurance, and sometimes just reassuring a person that they don't have cancer or an infection or don't need an operation is sufficient. Reassurance that they're going to get better soon. When you hurt, when you have an acute injury, you don't do as much. Your function is less, and that leads to more and more musculoskeletal pain that needs rehabilitation. So physical modalities, rehabilitation, physical therapy is very important.
And how often do you get people who just, you know what, they want the medicine? They want to go straight to the medicine because it's just they don't want to deal with it.
Well, we see that in our chronic pain clinic, but it's probably more prevalent in acute pain. America's a society that wants quick fixes, a pill to fix this or that, and that's not really the right approach.
All right. You know, the opioid crisis has disproportionately hit lower-income communities. Do less affluent people have access to see pain management specialists like yourself? And if so, how do we deal with that?
Well, we have a There's pain doctors throughout society, private practice, academic institutions that treat all patients, all comers. I would say, though, that less affluent or maybe people without insurance at all have restricted access, but that's not just to pain management, that's to medical care in general.
And then we talk about even people who do have insurance, some of these alternative treatments, and you know what, let's talk about what some of those are. What are some of the other things that you would recommend? Because you talked about, you know, some physical therapy as well. But what are some of the other treatments that you have led your patients towards in helping them deal with pain outside of drugs?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll tell them the spectrum of options and then find out what's best for them. The spectrum of options include the physical modalities, acupuncture, potentially chiropractic manipulation, effective cognitive behavioral therapy, learning how to cope with pain better.
Effective cognitive behavioral therapy.
CBT.
Okay.
Cognitive behavioral therapy.
Briefly, what is that?
Learning how to think or behave differently. Think about the pain differently or not let it change a person's function and behavior.
But I still have to live with it.
Yes, but if you think about it differently and you try to be as functional as possible, your pain can be less. And that's really the goal of pain management, not lowering a pain score from severe to moderate, although that's not bad, but it's improving function. What can't you do because of the pain, and what do you want to do?
All right, so does that mean, I mean, how do you go about that? Do I go see a therapist? How am I changing my mind about the pain I'm feeling?
Well, good pain management should be an integrated, multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary approach involving a gatekeeper, which ideally is a pain specialist, and then based upon what the pain specialist decides is necessary, bringing in other specialists, the physical medicine rehabilitation specialists, pain psychology, psychiatry, treatment of depression, and then there's medication that are adjuncts. Pain management does not equal opioids.
Something interesting. You talk about, you mentioned earlier, you said we live in a society, they want they want resolution as soon as possible. These don't sound like resolution that comes quickly. And some of it, as you said, is changing the way we think about pain. So it almost sounds like you have to make a massive shift in the culture in how they think about pain.
That's correct. It's interesting, other countries look at pain differently, and every culture looks at pain differently, and we can learn a lot from that.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Dennis Patton. He is an anesthesiologist at the University of Miami, whose work focuses extensively on pain management. And we've been talking about the opioid crisis, and one of the aspects of that crisis is maybe perhaps how we are looking at pain management, not as the full solution, just one of many possible solutions. So, you know, you mentioned all of these different possible treatments, doctor. how many of them are covered by insurance? Because this now becomes another problem.
Well, the causes of the opioid epidemic are varied. I can think of at least a dozen, and one of them I call the malalignment of the key players: patients, doctors, insurance companies, pharmacies, and government organizations. But you mentioned in insurance. Paradoxically, insurances sometimes do not cover physical therapy, or they cover it for a limited period of time, or they won't cover a brand name, non-generic medication, saying the patient has to fail morphine or oxycodone in one of its forms first, things that we precisely don't want to give the patient.
So are you working with doctors in any way? Because we go back to the very first thing you said, is that doctors, there are doctors out there just don't know and understand pain management. They need the training so that they can then decide how to help their patients. I mean, have you spent any time with doctors and trying to help them, or who is doing that?
Well, if you look at opioid prescriptions, the majority of opioid prescriptions are written by non-pain specialists. That's for both the short-acting and the long-acting medication. The University of Miami is the medical school. We're actually involved with them, teaching the medical students pain management. We give lectures to the various specialties, general surgery, internal medicine, family medicine, et cetera. But, of course, you can't learn it all. So one of the things we tell the people we're talking to is that our specialty exists. This is what we do. This is what pain management is all about. And refer patients to us, and then we're the specialist. So we'll take care of it.
From this point forward, as you look at how the state, how law enforcement, how doctors, how the industry, how pharmaceutical companies are moving forward on this issue, what do you think is the most pressing problem we have to fix right now?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I think curbing opioids in society is the number one problem right now.
We have to get people to stop using medications in some cases. Not completely, but...
Correct. And a side effect of that, there will be patients that need opioids and their primary care doctors won't be willing to prescribe them. And that'll probably force the doctors to send patients to us, and then we can take care of them.
Let me finish with this. What do you think about this lawsuit right now, going after the pharmaceutical industry?
I see both sides of that equation. The pharmaceutical industry is only one of many factors that led to this, but unfortunately they're quite prominent and potentially have deep pockets, and it's easy to point out, but they're not the main reason for the problem.
Fascinating conversation. I know it's what, you know, talking about pain management, I think probably needs a little bit more time than we have for today. But again, talking with Dr. Dennis Patton, again, an anesthesiologist at the University of Miami. He's actually an associate professor of clinical anesthesiology at the university. And again, talking about pain management and what role does that play in how we deal with the opioid crisis. Dr. Patton, I really appreciate the time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Lewis.
All right, still to come, we're going to talk to the woman in Miami who's bringing beehives to public spaces. That's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Colony collapse remains a problem for honeybees, which is why their popularity is growing around the country. Ordinary people are getting into beekeeping, starting hives in their backyards and even in rooftops in big cities. In Miami, Danielle Bender is trying to bring bees to public spaces, and she's doing it through the grant from the Miami Foundation Public Space Challenge, which she was a winner last year. The applications, by the way, are due this week for this year's challenge. And we spoke to her when she only had one hive set up, and now she's got many. She's got it going on. All right, Danielle, it's great to have you back.
Thank you for having me again. I'm so happy to be here.
By the way, how are the bees doing? How's the health of your bees?
My bees are doing great. We had a, a couple of hiccups and bumps along the road, but they're doing great now, and we're growing and expanding, so that's really exciting.
You won this the Miami Foundation Public Space Challenge, and the plan was to bring beehives to public spaces and parks. So when we first spoke, you've had just that one hive set up, and now you are spreading out into a number of different places. Tell me about where they are and how many you have now.
Sure. So I have, our first location was at, it's in Little River, and it's called Center for Subtropical Affairs. It's a formerly industrial lot that they're turning into an educational eco center. So we started off with one hive there. Now we're up to three. And hopefully we'll be expanding a couple more there. And then we just opened our second location, which is in Alapata at Little River Cooperative's nursery. And our third location is going to be in Opa-locka. It's at a neighborhood lot in conjunction with Health in the Hood. And then the last one we're looking to do is one of my amazing volunteers, Christian, who attends Miami-Dade College, is looking to get a couple of hives at one of their North campuses. So that's where we're at right now. And we have a couple requests for other locations, but trying to make sure I do everything the right way first.
Now, there's something that, you do that's really cool is that you invite people to come out and you basically, you teach them as much as you can about the bees and you let them get in there with the bees you know, they put on the bee suits and they get to overcome their fears. Let's go back to your story. It's fascinating where you came up with this idea for the challenge, because at the very beginning, you were afraid of bees.
Yes.
Why did you want to do this?
So I guess this would go back to talking about the Miami Foundation a little bit, but I had seen reports that bees were already, you know, having struggles maintaining their populations. And then I was seeing news reports that Zika spraying was, you know, affecting bees as well. And, you know, I didn't know much about bees. I didn't know if either of those were correct, but it was something that concerned me. So I proposed a public space challenge, thinking that it was something that would happen. And then I was contacted by a news channel to see if they could interview me and come to my beehives. And I was like, I don't have beehives. I'm not a beekeeper.
And so now you have to get into bees.
Yes.
And so you have to overcome this fear.
Yes.
Somebody helped you with that.
Yes. So my amazing mentor, Bianca Pistorius, she hosts hive visits at her personal home hives. And so we would go every Sunday, check out her hives. Every week there would be a different manipulation that we were trying or doing at her beehives. And you get to a point where there's only so much time you have to be nervous. And then when you realize nothing's happening, you sort of just calm down and observe. And it's really fascinating. You see all kinds of crazy stuff.
And now you do that for other people. Now you bring in, people come in from all over, and you take them to your hives, and you show them there's nothing to be afraid of. And you obviously you're educating them on how the hive works.
Yeah, so it started off with me being the person that led all of these visits with visitors that signed up to come see the hives. And then I got to a point where I felt I had exhausted my own knowledge and I really wanted to take a step back and keep learning. So I brought Bianca, who is the mentor I just mentioned. And so now she leads the sessions. A session can be anywhere from three people. We sometimes have 12 people. These are predominantly people that have never been around bees before, are either curious, want to have an educational experience, or really just trying to, you know, bucket list, knock off one of the fears and, you know, conquer their fear.
You had a great story last time, and I bet you've got some other great ones now of, you know, people who come in and they're just so reluctant. They don't want to do this. Look, bees are scary. You know, they're scary because we've been taught that they should be scary.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, what's one of your favorite stories recently?
Well, I have a couple. And one that I thought about recently is, so when I was talking about expanding to the garden in Opa-locka, there's a young lady named Corrine. She is the garden manager in Opa-locka. And we had talked to her about, would she be interested in, you know, training and mentoring and becoming one of the beekeepers? And she was super excited. So she wanted to come do a visit at our Little Haiti location, Little Haiti, Little River location. And she came and brought her daughter along, her daughter Tatiana. And Tatiana was a little apprehensive, a little nervous. And by the end of the visit, was holding frames of bees, was really interested, asking questions, tasting all the honeys. And by the end of the visit, she was asking if she could be one of the beekeepers in training alongside with her mom. So I think that being face to face with bees and seeing that they're not out to sting you, they're really just preoccupied with doing their business, makes people feel a little less apprehensive about them.
I got to tell you this too, by the way, is that you have a fantastic Instagram account. Beautiful photographs of the beehives. You out there with people in the bee suits working on the beehives. I still think about that one picture, though, of a bee pooping.
Yes.
Which I never thought of, but I guess all creatures have to.
It's kind of gross.
So what's the goal now? Your work, I mean, you've got this, you've expanded to this point now, mm-hmm. but you want to get out to more spaces and you want to get to public parks.
Yes, I do. The goal is to now that I've reached a limit where my understanding of bees has expanded beyond my original proposal, now I'm really trying to focus on workshops that include native bees as well, which are having a lot harder of a time than honeybees. So providing art-based workshops that make them a little bit more understood by the average person. So we use honeybees as an introduction to bees, where people can get to know them, get excited about them, and then be introduced to native bees. I have a pamphlet that I brought for you, but we're doing a workshop with University of Miami's Women in Architecture program through their School of Architecture. I commissioned them to rethink the idea of having native bee hotels where solitary bees can all live together. And so the amazing women in this program put together their ideas and we've created two prototype beehives. So we're going to be at Little River Co-op this Saturday providing all the materials. People have already signed up. I think I have a couple of spots left, but people have signed up. They get to build these native hotels, bring them home, and then provide access for native bees to exist in their yard. And you don't even need to be a beekeeper to have them.
And by the way, you sent me a picture of the hotels. Lovely hotels. No pool, though, but that's
no
too
pool.
Bad. Real quickly, before we finish up, is, as I mentioned, the application period for the public spaces competition is coming up this week. What advice do you give anybody? Since you're a winner, what would you say to somebody if they thought they had an idea?
My number one bit of advice would be to not be discouraged by what you don't know or not feel like you're not experienced enough to submit something. All you have to have is a good idea. I was not a beekeeper when I proposed this project, and I am now, and I'm getting a lot of other people inspired and interested in beekeeping, so you don't have to be the expert at what you're proposing at all. That's my number one bit of advice.
And you were afraid of bees, and look at you now.
Yeah.
So, again, Danielle Bender, she was last year's winner of the Miami Foundation Public Space Challenge. Again, she is bringing beehives to public spaces, and she wants to get them into parks as well throughout the area. She's already got a few, by the way. We'll have a link on our Facebook so you can check it out, because you could sign up to go and she'll get you out there so that you could check out those hives and she'll teach you as much as she can about bees and get you past that fear if you have any. Again, check out some of those photos. They're fantastic. Danielle, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Can I do a quick plug of my Instagram?
Do it.
It's public_hives. And if you want to visit the website to sign up for a visit, it's publichives.org.
Perfect. And but you're booked up to June, so
yep.
Get on that list. Thanks again, Danielle.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. We'll meet coming up soon. We're going to meet a singer from Parkland who is performing at the West Palm Beach Festival Sunfest. She is on the same card as Pitbull. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Parkland native Sonali Argaday has launched herself into the pop rock music scene. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas graduate is playing Sunfest this weekend just before Pitbull and recently released the EP Close Enough.
When you see my lips, do you remember? 'Cause when I see your smile, I surrender. Don't tell me that this means nothing to you.
Sonali joined us in our studios and for an acoustic performance and a far-reaching conversation from her struggles with Lyme disease to growing up in suburban Parkland.
We moved to Parkland from, I was born in Los Angeles, and we moved here when I was three, so I've pretty much spent my entire life in Parkland, and I think it's probably one of the best places you could ever hope to raise a family or grow up. It's just, it's a very safe neighborhood. It totally has that small town feel, but at the same time, you're not too far from a city like Miami if you do want to get out and kind of leave that suburban area. And it's just a very community-oriented town, as you can really tell right now with everything that's going on.
Yeah. And were you involved in the music program at school, or was it outside of school?
Both. So I was really heavily involved with the Stoneman Douglas Chorus all my 4 years, and I loved doing that. I played at School of Rock. I took lessons there for fun, and I was always just kind of writing on my own. And I studied at the Player School of Music, and I think it was the summer of 10th grade, and that really opened my eyes. That was an incredible learning experience.
Yeah, when did it all start for you? I mean, is it you were that kid walking around the house always singing, or when did you start realizing, wait a minute, I'm actually pretty good at this.
I was. I know this is such like the most lame cliche story, so I hate saying this, but I was that kid who was singing before I was talking and like not even able to form actual English words. And I very seriously told my parents when I was 3 years old that I was going to be a singer. But every 3 year old says something ridiculous like that. But mm-hmm. I meant it.
What kind of stuff were you singing around the house?
Honestly, I think the first stuff I started writing was country music, and nobody in my family listens to country music. I didn't even listen to country music until pretty recently, actually, so I have no idea where that came from.
You were living in Parkland when the shooting happened.
Yes.
Where were you that day? What were you doing?
I was actually at the vet with my dog, and my mom was there too, and I was just scrolling on my phone. We'd been waiting there for hours, and all of a sudden I saw a Facebook live stream, and it said shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. They hadn't, it was about probably 15 minutes after it happened, so they didn't have the suspect, and they said possibly two wounded, and I couldn't believe it. I grabbed my mom immediately, and I was like, oh my God, look at this. And I don't think we really realized the gravity of the situation at that point, because it just looked like, you know, two wounded. It didn't seem like it was going to be as horrible as it was.
And then hours later, you find out what really happened.
Yeah.
And what are you thinking at that point? Did you still have friends, or did you know anybody at the school?
I have friends who have siblings there, but I didn't know anyone personally. But yeah, I mean, I have friends who had siblings in that building who had to hear all that and see all that. And I mean, I can't imagine seeing that at any age, let alone being 14, 15 years old.
What do you think about the fact that we've seen, if maybe one good thing comes out of this, is that you see this uprising of youth from the school becoming extremely vocal on a national level? But I don't know, what you know, it's your generation still. What goes through your mind when you see that?
I think it's absolutely amazing and inspiring to be able to turn that kind of grief into activism. Like, that's just an amount of resilience that's rare to be seen. But honestly, it doesn't surprise me at all coming from Stoneman Douglas. Like, it is an incredible school. All the teachers that you keep hearing their names mentioned, like Mr. Foster and Miss Wolk Rogers, I had them all. They're incredible. Like, it doesn't surprise me in any way.
You know, like any songwriter, you know, sometimes tragedy can inspire. Did anything from that horrible tragedy and subsequently what's happened since inspire any kind of music that you've been working on?
It has inspired some lyrics, nothing that I've finished yet, because it's so hard to, you know, to write about something like this, because you want to do it in a way that gives it the justice it deserves, and it's complicated. It's tough stuff, so you really have to get it right.
Now, you talk about academics, but you came back to Parkland after several years in New York City. You were at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. How did living in the Big Apple and working with those students influence your music, and how did it help you, force you to grow up?
In so many ways. I think even though I always knew I wanted to pursue music, I was really very much focused on my academics when I was here. When I went to college, I was met with the same rigor of you know, talent and focus, but it was music, not academics as much. Not to say that academics wasn't a focus at NYU, but the same competition that I had academically in high school, I guess, I now had musically. And that forced me to grow so much, because you really have no option. It's easy to be a big fish in a small pond when you're coming from a city like Parkland, but all of a sudden I was at NYU Tisch, and everybody was just phenomenal. Like, they call it, this sounds like very pretentious, but they call it like the Harvard of popular music programs. And honestly, it was like, there isn't a single day that I'm not just floored by the level of talent that the kids there have. So you have no choice but to to get on that level and rise up.
What changed about your style, you know, after you spent time in New York? I mean, you talk about early on you're singing country music, but now, I mean, what did something change in your style and in the type of music that you're wanting to write and sing now?
Yeah, a lot. I've gone through a couple of genre changes, actually, and I think that's really cool, too, because you end up with what you're doing now and being this like combination of all these different influences, which is, I think, the best way to make music. So when I got to NYU, I was still very much finding myself in terms of genre. And my freshman year, one of my really good friends, who was my roommate, and a couple of my friends down the hall were super into folk music and, you know, a lot of like Simon and Garfunkel and Joni Mitchell and stuff like that. And at that time, in popular music, bands like Mumford and Sons and American Authors were really coming up. So there was this whole like folk insurgence thing kind of happening. I remember Ed Sheeran was getting really big too. So that whole like singer-songwritery thing was happening, and that influenced me both sonically and as a songwriter so much. So my EP that I ended up releasing in 2014 was very like folk pop inspired.
Let's talk about one of those songs, "Close Enough." This is a new single.
So "Close Enough" is really a song about a relationship that's in a gray area and is kind of undefined.
When you see my lips, do you remember? 'Cause when I see your smile, I surrender. Don't tell me that this means nothing to you. You can't tell me that you really feel through. We can talk and say that we're alright. I can laugh with you all through the night. Yeah, I can still tell you anything, 'cause once you were my everything. Friends who are too close, or loves who aren't close enough. Are we victims of a game with rules that are just too rough?
Again, I'm talking with performer Sonali Argaday. She goes by Sonali. She's joining me here in studio. She's from Parkland. She went to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. You eventually came back to Florida last year because of an illness. Mm-hmm. When did you discover you had Lyme disease?
So I didn't formally receive a diagnosis until February of 2017. But I've been struggling with health issues since probably 2009, about that time. I have no idea if that was Lyme disease or if that was something entirely unrelated. But I didn't get an actual diagnosis until last year.
And after you got the diagnosis, I mean, what did you know about this disease beforehand? And you know, what is it? For a lot of people, they've heard of it. They may not know.
Yeah, so Lyme disease is, you get it from a tick. It's a tick-borne illness. Classically, a lot of people will get a bullseye rash and a fever, and that's how you know if you have it. So if you're lucky enough to realize that you have it right away, you just go to your doctor, you get antibiotics, you take doxycycline for about 4 weeks, and you're good. And it's not the worst thing in the world. But for a lot of people, we don't realize we have it. And that's when it has the possibility of becoming chronic, which it is in my case. And once you get to that level, curing it is the whole nother thing and becomes a lengthy process.
Yeah, how has that impacted your music and your ability to perform?
Incredibly. I mean, I completely stopped doing music or anything really for about 2 years because it was so bad that I couldn't even leave my bed. I just didn't have the energy, and I felt so sick that I couldn't. And like I said, I didn't get my diagnosis until last year. So I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought I was lazy. I thought I was unmotivated. I did feel relieved that it had a name and it was a tangible thing now that had a treatment plan, and that made me feel better about it.
And have you taken this experience, has that inspired any of your music?
Definitely. So the music I'm releasing right now, I wrote it, most of it, in like 2014, and I had this whole EP ready and I never got to release it because of my Lyme disease. So all the music I'm finally getting to release now, I actually wrote back then. So I have all this new stuff I've written since then that I'm just dying to record and get out because just, you know, so much has happened and it's shaped me so much.
All right, I want to talk about another song, "Turn It Around." Tell us a little bit about that one.
So it's funny because I wrote this in 2012 and I completely relate to it from a Lyme disease perspective now. So "Turn It Around" is a song, as the title suggests, it's about turning your life around. It's about picking yourself up from a hard place, and even when you feel like there's no way out, you get it together and you find that inner strength. And it's funny, I was thinking about like you said, I went to Stoneman Douglas, and there's this quote at the front of the school that says, "Be the change you wish to see in the world," from Gandhi. And it's right in the front of the school. It's the last thing you see when you walk out the red gates. And I wrote the song in 2012, which was my freshman year of college, and I was pretty nostalgic at the time, and I was thinking about home and Parkland, and it was that quote that I was thinking about when I wrote the song.
Do you ever look in the mirror and get tired of the eyes that stare back? And the record playing, it jumps back at the part it's supposed to change. I see what I am, what I'm not, and who I wanna be. It's like I forgot what I want, but that's not me. I pull my head out of the sand, it's easy to live underground. I open my eyes, now I found a way to turn it around.
When did you get the invitation to perform at Sunfest, and what did that mean for you? I mean, at this early stage of your career, to play at such a big festival. This is the festival up in West Palm Beach.
It means everything, especially the last few years. I've been beaten down, and there have been a lot more doors closed than open. And I have been at this at a while, and it's been so stop and start because of health issues and not knowing that I had Lyme disease and not knowing what was going on. So, you know, I would say that the last few years have been more discouraging than encouraging. And now it starts to feel, I'm cautiously optimistic, I say this with caution, but it feels like things are finally starting to fall into place. And even as a songwriter, there are no words I could possibly use to convey how much that means.
Well, Sonali, I really appreciate the time. Congratulations on everything. Good luck to you moving forward. Best health to you. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
And again, that was musician Sonali Argaday, who's performing Sunday at Sunfest just hours before Pitbull takes the stage. We have a video, by the way, of her performance on our roof. Just go to our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, it's Haitian Heritage Month. We're going to talk with South Florida Haitian author MJ Fiavre. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, May is Haitian Heritage Month, and one of the events in South Florida during May is the Little Haiti Book Festival. MJ Fiavre is one of the organizers involved with the festival, and she's an author of numerous mystery and horror books, most of them in French. But we're joined now by MJ Fiavre. MJ, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, I did tell you, I took a couple years of French, so I know that I got your name wrong at the beginning there, but I'm getting it. You know what I wanted to ask you about? Your focus has been on the Little Haiti Book Festival a lot. Where did the idea come from?
Well, the festival is the brainchild of Jean Mapou, who is a writer from Haiti, who's been in the U.S. for quite some time. So 6 years ago, he came up with the idea of organizing a festival that would bring Haitians and Haitian Americans together to celebrate all the beauty, all the wonderful culture from Haiti. He's in charge of Société Kukui, and Société Kukui recently partnered with the Miami Book Fair to make the festival even bigger.
You know, you talk about bringing Haitians and Haitian Americans together, and I'm sure so you were born and raised in Haiti.
I was.
You came here when you were, what, 21?
21.
21.
Yes.
What are the differences in that we don't usually see, but what that we don't think about between the Haitian diaspora and Haitians back in Haiti? How do people change when they come here?
Well, the big difference for me was obviously the language. I started my career as a writer in Haiti, writing in French, and my books were well welcomed. I felt part of the community. When I moved here to South Florida, it was very hard for me to find where I belonged, because our community here obviously has switched to English mostly when it comes to conversations, but for the writing, they're more interested in text in Creole as opposed to French, which was the language that I used for my writing. So it was a matter of having to find where I belonged and trying to find my community.
And it's interesting, most of your books, and you've been writing since you were 16.
Yes.
Most of your books are in French and Creole.
They are. Some dialogues in French, in Creole here and there, but when I was growing up, when I became a writer, Creole was still not as well established as it is today. So it was not the language of choice for writing. Today it is.
And I think I read about you that really, your best writing came when you arrived here in the United States. But you're writing about life back in Haiti.
Right, it did. There's something about being an immigrant, right? To take a step back and you're able to look at your life in your homeland and reflect in a way that you were not being able to before. I always compare it to being in front of a mirror. If you're too close to it, you can't see your flaws, but you also cannot see your own beauty. But when you step away, you're able to get the full picture.
All right, so you're writing again about the Haitian experience, and you brought a little something to share with us. You have a poem.
Yes, I do have a poem that I would like to share with you. Most of my writing, like I said, in Haiti was in French. When I moved here, I started writing a little bit more in Creole and also in English. And this is a poem that was published by Sor Palm, which is a Florida publication, and it's called Pain Perdu. When Abigail was 9 years old, a teacher in Port-au-Prince said, "If you don't stop frowning, by the time you're 30, you'll get all wrinkly." Abigail never did turn 30 or get these wrinkles, but in Miami, she worried. She worried about the spelling of the French word hippocampe, about the missing ingredient in a pain perdu recipe, about a Creole-infused accented speech, too fast, too slow. At night, she cried, frustrated that Haitian poet Coriolan Ardouin now seemed to belong to a past she couldn't hold on to. At night, she sat atop the roof, overlooking the begonias, brilliant beneath moon glow. The birds on the roof made her think about her mother's old sewing machine. The night of her death, Abigail said, "I saw my mother gasp for breath." She said, "Too many bodies on the boat to Miami. Somebody had to go." Her eyes were blazing, her mouth stretched wide. Before she jumped from the roof, Abigail drank Prestige beer and ate Dos Macos. She sang to the moon with a melody haïtienne scratching on the 8th track. Before she jumped, she laughed and twirled and spun, almost gasping for breath.
And you've been hearing from MJ Fiavre. She is an author, and she's also one of the organizers of the upcoming Little Haiti Book Festival. That was very lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know what? You've written mysteries, thrillers, horror as well.
Yes.
Well, your first book, though, was horror,
it
right?
It was a little bit of horror, a little bit of adventure. It was a young adult book. I was 16 at the time, so evidently I wrote for my age group. I was very, very green when it came to writing, and writing has always been my life, and coming to the U.S. and being able to fully connect to that part of myself was very important in terms of being able to live here as a real member of the community.
Are you still writing just for a Haitian audience?
Nowadays, I try to reach as many people as possible. I mostly write in English, although, like I mentioned, I do write in Creole as well and in French too. I think that my writing has become a little bit more universal as opposed to directly addressing a Haitian audience.
How much of, when you think about your youth, your growing up, but the first 21 years of your life, growing up in Haiti, and look, Haiti is just still undergoing so much change, but you were there during some really big, massive changes, good and bad, throughout the country. What are some of the memories that jump out at you that have impacted your writing most?
Well, I do remember a lot of good times, and also, of course, the bad times that are reported by the news. I think there's a lot of nostalgia, and because what the news usually serves us is the bad, I think that part of me really want to hold on to the good times. So I remember a lot about, you know, going to Catholic school and everything that the nuns taught me there about what it means to be a good person. And I think that I carried that with me, what it means to be a good Haitian person, caring about the country, even here in the U.S., the fact that we're still attached to Haiti and we want what is good for Haiti. There are so many people like me who want to, you know, keep the culture going and keep a fresh image of the good old times that they knew back there in the homeland.
Talking about your writing, and again, so much of it is in French, but you are writing more now in English. But are there ideas or language that you can only express in French or Creole that there isn't an English translation for?
Well, you know, usually it's difficult to know what language you're going to use for a particular piece. It's the same way that I don't always know what form the piece is going to take, if it's going to be a poem, if it's going to be the beginning of a novel. I just follow my heart, you know, and whatever needs to be expressed in a certain language, I will use that language so that the message can be crisper.
Let's talk about the upcoming, again, it is Haitian Heritage Month, but let's talk a little bit about the festival, the Little Haiti Book Festival, and what sort of events and experiences are people going to have there? Who's going to be there?
It's going to be an amazing event. It starts on Saturday, May 5th. We're going to open the festival with Edwige Danticat, who is an award-winning author, an inspiration to all of us from Haiti. And she's going to be in conversation with Jacqueline Charles, who is the Haiti correspondent for the Miami Herald, an amazing individual who's done so much in terms of giving a real reportage on Haiti, on the situation on Haiti, very interesting conversation between two very, very inspirational Haitian women. On Sunday, we're going to have a series of panels with Haitian authors who are going to come from Haiti or from other parts of the state, and also some of those authors are local. So we're getting points of view from different backgrounds, different experiences. We're going to have workshops. We are going to have a lot of activities for the children, all centered around the drums. So the kids are going to be exposed to storytelling about Haiti with drumming. We're hoping that people will come to discover more of our culture. It's really about creating community. It's not a festival that is only aimed at Haitian people. It's really a way for everybody to discover a culture that is beautiful.
Again, that's author MJ Fiav. She is also one of the organizers for the Little Haiti Book Festival. It is Haitian Heritage Month. We'll have more information, by the way, on our Facebook page, so you can find out more about these events that are coming up. MJ, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And that's the program for today. Thank you again so much for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you tomorrow.